This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross. Our first guest, David O. Russell, directed and co-wrote the movie American Hustle, which is nominated for 10 Oscars, including Best Picture, Best Director, and Best Original Screenplay. It's tied with Gravity for the most nominations. Russell's previous two films, Silver Linings Playbook and The Fighter, also received nominations for Best Picture and Best Director. American Hustle is set in 1978 and is inspired by the Abscam scandal, in which the FBI worked with a con artist to set up a sting, using a phony Arab sheikh to offer bribes to politicians. In American Hustle, Christian Bale plays a con man who, along with his partner, played by Amy Adams, is busted by an FBI agent played by Bradley Cooper. The agent coerces them into working with him on a sting he's setting up to go after politicians. Terry spoke with Russell last Thursday and began with a scene from early in the film, before Christian Bale's character Irving and Amy Adams' character Sydney become partners. After they kiss in one of the dry cleaning stores he owns, he takes her into his office and explains the scam where he really makes his money.
Why'd you bring me here?
This is getting to be my main business, my going business. I help get loans for guys who can't get loans. You know, I'm their last resort.
You're their last resort. His interest rates are north of 12% and heading to 18%.
That's right, smarty pants.
Jimmy Carter.
F***ing Jimmy Carter.
Nixon, really. And the war and the deficit and all of that.
Oh, you're so smart. You are.
Thanks, kid, but how do you get them the money?
Well.
You don't, do you? You don't.
These guys are lousy risks. You know, I can't get them a loan, but I get my fee, $5,000.
$5,000? You take $5,000, you don't give them anything.
Right? These are bad guys. You know, they got bad divorces, gambling habits, embezzling, all that shit. You know what I mean?
Everybody at the bottom crosses paths eventually in a pool of desperation, and you're waiting for them.
How about we?
We.
Yeah. How about it? Sydney. Sydney, I'm sorry. That was too much. I went too far. I didn't want to upset you. Sydney, please, I'm sorry.
I know it ain't for everybody.
Oh, God, I love getting to know you.
David O. Russell, welcome back to Fresh Air. Both in Silver Linings Playbook, where the Robert De Niro character is a kind of small-time bookie, and in American Hustle, where, you know, two of the main characters are running a con, you're interested in, you know, like small-time criminals. And I'm wondering what makes you interested in those characters.
Well, what makes me interested in any characters is their heart and their soul. I'm not interested in small-time criminals per se. I mean, Silver Linings was a little different for me because, to me, De Niro's character was kind of doing bookmaking on the side. My grandfather on my mother's side was a bookmaker for most of his life out of a diner on Canal Street in New York. And I don't know that he ever considered himself a small-time criminal, you know. But I just love people who, in Silver Linings, it was more of he was interestingly as superstitious and OCD as his son in some ways, or had his own rules of craziness, which many people have about their rituals of their work or their superstitions, especially in betting or especially in sports. And, you know, that to me was interesting because look how that's like sanctioned craziness, whereas, you know, a different kind of craziness lands you in a mental hospital. I just found that interesting. I'm interested in predicaments that can create local, specific characters that I can be riveted by. So that was true in The Fighter, where there was also a criminal, the Christian Bale character, or Silver Linings, or American Hustle. They're characters who are very local, very specific, and they're in predicaments that cause them, you start out and they're in a lot of trouble, and they spend the entire movie reckoning with the trouble they're in and who they're going to be and who they're going to love and how they're going to live. The emotional entanglements are what interest me as much as the financial or criminal entanglements.
Can I get back to that your grandfather was a bookie who worked out of a diner on Canal Street? Was he alive when you were old enough to...
No, I didn't get to see it. He died like the year I was born, but he was sort of worshipped by my mom and I heard her talk about him a lot. What else did he do? He ran a diner. Oh, he ran a couple of restaurants.
Oh, it was his diner.
Yeah, it was his diner, yeah.
Oh, on Canal Street. Wow, that had to be interesting.
Yeah, I know. See what I'm talking about? You know, so like one of my producers on The Fighter, Jeff Waxman, had a family in Long Island that had a candy store and a diner, and it's just everything time he talks about it, and his father recently passed away, he's so much love and light for the local characters and Left Hand Louie and all these guys who were in this. I just love magic. I just think I find an enchantment in these local places. I think that sometimes things that people overlook, or if you said to them, isn't this great, they would look behind them and go, what are you talking about? Because they're in it and they wouldn't know. But if you tried to take it away from them, they would say, oh, this is special.
You write great dialogue, and you've talked about how you like your dialogue to be almost like music, like a song. But there's a few lines I especially like, just as outstanding lines. And these two lines get to the scam that the Christian Bale character is running. And the scam is that people come to you who are desperate for loans and can't get it anyplace else. And you say you're going to do your best to get it for them. You charge them $5,000 for your consultancy. Then you decide, you know, you just don't qualify for the loan, but they never get the consultancy $5,000 back. So he just keeps collecting all these fees. And so he says to the Christian Bale character says to one of these guys, my fee is non-refundable like my time.
Just like my time.
Yeah, it's a great line. Yeah. And another one, you know, because everybody who really desperately needs this money wants these loans. And the more he says, no, I don't think you're going to qualify, the more they want it. So he says, the more you say no to people, the more they want in on it. So can you talk a little bit about coming up with those lines? Because they seem perfect for the character. They're very colorful, very concise.
The first line, I think, is a line that the actual guy said, that Christian Bale and I interfaced with a little bit, Christian more so than me. There's a lot of specific language you pick up when you're in Lowell, Massachusetts, or, you know, Ridley Park, you know, near outside Philly, Upper Darby, or in these neighborhoods in New York around this Mel Weinberg character. So he said that line. He says he actually breaks up like this, and my fee, just like my time, is non-refundable, which is a great line. The other one I wrote, which is... I find it to be true. I find human behavior to be fascinating, that the more you say no to people, the more they want in on something. I mean, that's how Madoff happened. Because, you know, people said, oh, you know, he said no to a lot of rich things. Oh, can you get me in? Can you get me in? You know, then you got to get in. It's crazy. He says it's so stupid. I think it's kind of stupid.
Several of the main characters in American Hustle want to or need to reinvent themselves. The movie starts with the Christian Bale character looking in the mirror, gluing on his toupee, and it's a really awful toupee. And we see
a toupee. No, it's his own hair.
It's just a hairpiece? Oh, it's
No, it's his own hair. He combs his hair. It's a comb over. That he puts he does put a little, they have like some kind of wool that people can put in there on their head. They can glue it to the top of their head. I mean, I watch many people, my dad's friends, and even my dad, construct themselves. To me, the movie is about what that scene is about, really, and him making his hair. It's not just his hair. It's really what the whole movie's about, which is about the fragility of identity. I think identity is fragile. I think it's got a big piece to it that is chosen or changed as the need may be. And I think love is also fragile and is living and shifting, like shifting ground under your feet. So that interests me. And how everybody has that vulnerability and that fragility of who they're going to be at any time, you know, whether it's Christian Bale in The Fighter or Bradley Cooper in Silver Linings, you know, or Jennifer Lawrence in Silver Linings, you know, who are they going to be? Who are they now and who are they going to be? And how's that going for them? You know, how's that going for you? You know, so I find that interesting.
So the movie starts with Christian Bale kind of physically recreating himself. And we see his big belly, and it's as if to say this person has to recreate himself like every day. But the interesting thing to me is that the movie is about, you know, self-recreation, self-invention. The character's physically recreating himself, but Christian Bale recreated himself physically to play the part. He gained a lot of weight. He has this very, like, New York accent. He took on a completely different posture. I read he actually herniated a disc because of the slouchy posture and the weight that he gained and everything. When you cast Christian Bale to play this part, had you imagined that he would physically recreate himself in the way that he did?
I didn't think he would go as far as he did. That's really his decision. You know, I knew that it would be exciting and enticing to him to lose himself in this person. That's what actors who love characters kind of live for. You know, they can take some part of their own soul, some part of my soul and the screenplay's soul, and the actual character that they who they think the real character is, the real person, and it becomes this amalgam of a human that they get to live in, like in a trance or like a dream, you know, during the movie. Jennifer Lawrence has described it as a high. Christian describes it as like a waking dream. And that's one of the reasons that the way I shoot is I like to shoot 20-minute mags of film, and I still shoot film, on a Steadicam. That's why I'm in the room with the actors. And we don't call cut because I don't want them to break the spell that they're in. I just want it to get deeper and deeper. So I'll just keep directing take after take while the camera resets or keeps moving through the room, and they kind of stay in character, whether they're talking to me or not, or whether I'm giving them lines or ideas or adjustments.
So when you say that you have them do take after take without calling cut, do you mean take after take of the same scene or take after take in order that you're shooting? Because imagine you'd need a different setup for the next scene.
Well, we tend to light. Like if you walked onto our set, you wouldn't see a lot of lights or anything. It would look like you were walking into a room or a house because we light from the ceiling, like a soft source from above or from the windows, a natural soft light that can still be very beautiful and have different levels to it and is soft. But it's fast. It's fast for them to do it, and it's not going to take up our shooting time. And it means the actors and I can pretty much go anywhere in the room. So when I say take after take, I mean to keep redoing the scene in a way until we feel like we've gotten some very exciting versions of it. And sometimes we get different versions of it because sometimes you don't know if it should be done hotter or cooler or quieter or bigger. That's part of the exploration of the instrument of cinema and characters and voices, is to play them at different levels. That's interesting.
There's a voiceover narration that I want to play from early in the film. And this is the Christian Bale character, in part explaining how he became involved in a small-time con game. So here's Christian Bale. Oh, we can't. I'm sorry. Because of something going on in the control room, I can't play that for you now. But you know.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Hey, you want me to do it for you?
No, it's okay.
Okay.
I mean, you're welcome to.
Go ahead. Hold on. Let me turn it. Hold on. Wait a second. Did you ever have to survive and you knew all your choices were bad? I learned how to survive when I was a kid. My father ran a glass business in the Bronx. I would much rather be on the taking side than on the being taken side any day of the week, especially after I saw how my father got taken. I mean, that scarred me for life, you know. So I became a different kind of person, you know. I became a con artist from the feet up all the way. That's pretty close to
That's good. So, and you shot it a while ago, but you still remember it.
Well, I've watched it about 100 million times.
Okay, but I interview so many actors who have completely forgotten their lines.
Well, that's an actor. They do it, then they leave, and they go do another movie in Morocco with Ridley Scott or something. I'm still in the edit room with the same person.
You've pointed out that self-invention was the theme of your last three films, American Hustle, Silver Linings Playbook, and The Fighter. And in American Hustle, Christian Bale's character says, you know, about the Amy Adams character, like me, she learned to survive and she knew she'd have to reinvent herself. And Amy Adams says, my dream more than anything was to become anyone else other than who I was. What resonated with that in your life, the whole theme of self-invention? I mean, I know you feel like you've become and you have become, a much better filmmaker, although I liked your other films too. No apology needed for those films. But just in terms of like more personal things, like what is self-invention a theme that's been important in your life as well?
It became one to my great discovery once I came back from sort of what I call my wilderness period, which is sort of after Three Kings, which includes Huckabee's. It's a period that comprises about 9 years, if you really look at it, you know, where I kind of ponderously rewrote. I've always been a writer first, and I'll spend most of my life writing and rewriting many screenplays. And I rewrote Huckabee's 5 different versions. And right now, I'm now wise enough to know, I would sit back and say to me, whoa, what are you doing? why don't you just instinctively from your heart grab one of these and really put your heart into it and don't be in your head too much and don't look at every way you can tell the story. You could do that forever. You know, you can tell, you have to act from instinct and commit yourself. And, you know, that I learned that the hard way. You know, I think I was a little scared after Three Kings. I wanted to take a big creative risk and I overthought it. I wrote it many different, it's happened to many filmmakers, by the way. So I came out of that 9-year period, which also included a divorce. And I just came back a humbler storyteller, you know, meaning just clearer, grateful to tell stories, telling them from instinct, not overthinking them, telling them from the heart, suddenly seeing all these characters who'd been under my nose all my life, the people I'd been embarrassed of, or wouldn't, you know, like when I first met you on Spanking the Monkey, you know, I think I had kind of a younger person's criticism or embarrassment about my family, you know. Anyway, so I went through that whole period and came out, I think, a better storyteller. And, you know, actually that's how I got Silver Linings, was the beginning of the comeback to me, the reinvention. It was at Sidney Pollack in the last year of his life. I was the writer for Hire, and he said, David, I would like you to adapt this screenplay. I couldn't even be attached to it as director yet. And he said, I can't find anybody who knows how to do this story, because it's sort of, it could be very disturbing, but I think it should also be human and warm, and I don't know how to make it also funny. And I said, well, I do, because I've lived it, and I'd like to make it personal to my experience and change how the novel is, the wonderful novel. And I'm very sorry he didn't live to see it. And then I couldn't get it made. So I then made The Fighter, thanks to my friend Mark Wahlberg. You know, he just had a lot of faith in me, and I could feel that from the instinct. I loved the relationship of the women. The women became like the napalm in my movie, you know, starting from that movie. I thought women are just the women are where it's all at for me.
What was that movies. Great fight scene between all the sisters and Amy Adams?
That's how I got Amy to do the movie, was I'd only known her from having lunch with her a few times, and everybody said, Amy Adams, the princess from Enchanted. I mean, what are you doing? Do we even really need that character to be a big character? I said, yes, because the romance is essential to me. I love romance. That was where I realized I loved romance. When you met me on Spanking the Monkey, I don't know, you know? I will happily carry the banner for romance.
But did romance seem like too corny?
Not cool. Uh-huh. Not cool.
One of the things I really enjoyed about American Hustle is that watching it, I felt I was watching a movie made by somebody who loves movies and loves making movies. That there just seemed to be a joy in filmmaking. A joy in, like, the rhythm of it and the colors and what people were wearing and the line, just like the energy of it, the musicality of it. It sounds like I'm just...
Oh, no, please, put that in the interview. I'm glad you said that.
Praising you, but I genuinely felt that watching it, you enjoyed doing this. Did you?
Yes. I mean, you have to... I put enormous love into it and passion into it. And since it's a passionate story about people doing passionate things that are sometimes rather desperate things, you know, everything's a little life and death, and the struggles they're going through are a little life and death and a little desperate. So I love the dramatic movement of the camera, you know. I love the intuitive feeling of the camera moving into a person as they're having emotions and as they're saying things. And as that's moving, the dialogue is happening. And as that's happening, the song starts to happen. That's magical to me. And I play music on the set sometimes just to set the mood or break the mood. And sometimes it's the music that we're going to be editing to. Or sometimes it's just the music I want people to feel energetically that may not be in the scene. But
what's an example of something that you use that's not necessarily in the movie, but you wanted to give that energy to the scene?
When Bradley Cooper was running the streets in Silver Linings Playbook, and, you know, he's a phenomenal collaborator and a phenomenal actor who is fearless, and his resources are deeper than anything anybody expects. And I think he's going to morph, and he is morphing. And he's also there in the edit room with us, and he's a real partner to me in every step of the shooting day and into the editing room. And he hangs around quite a bit. I'm delighted to have him as a friend and as a collaborator. I went up to him and I said, and we have a very intuitive feeling about scenes and people and cinema, and it's good, you know. And I'll go up to him and I said, listen, which actually is a Beatles drum solo from Abbey Road. Ringo Starr's only, the Beatles' only drum solo ever. actually, is that drum solo in the medley on side two of Abbey Road. And I said, that's the rhythm that's in your head, which is like a nervous energy as you're running through town. It's a hopeful energy, and it's also a nervous energy as you're running through town out of the hospital, looking around the streets for your ex-wife or your wife. You want her to still be your wife. And you're going to go to your old high school where you taught with her, and you're going to go to her old, the house you lived in with her where the trauma happened that broke you up. And that's that. And that's explained a lot to him, that rhythm.
So the Oscars are coming up really soon. Big night for you. 10 Oscar nominations. When you're nominated for a lot of Oscars, I think I asked Bradley Cooper this too, like, when you know that the camera's going to be on you, like, what if you lose? You know, like, and you have to look like, oh, it's going to a great person. I'm so happy for them, whether you're feeling that way or not. Is that a really awkward moment?
When that moment happens with the camera, I mean, actually, I'll tell you a funny story, okay? Mm-hmm. When I was at the BAFTAs last year, sitting next to Jennifer Lawrence.
This is another award ceremony.
Yeah, the British Academy Awards. And on the other side of Jennifer was, you know, Holly, my significant other. And at the moment that the Best Actress Award was announced, she didn't win. The woman from Amour won. And I, being loyal to Jennifer, who was sitting next to me, you know, me being a sort of demonstrative person or an emotional person, I made a, if you can look it up online, because it became a screen grab, right? It became a screen grab. Because Holly, at the very moment, Holly leans over to go, "You're on camera, David. Like, be careful." Like, I was kind of going, like, if you could see my mouth, it's like a Peanuts character when they're going, "Wah!" Like, upside down kind of a frown, you know. It's like, that's a really kind of a cartoonish frown. I'm going, "Wah!" And if you look it up, it says, "David O. Russell, douche face." You know, like, ungracious reaction to Jennifer Lawrence losing the BAFTA. And it became a screen grab. And I just, you know, people asked me about it. I said, what can I tell you? You know, I'm loyal to my actors. You know, I would never do that for me. You know what I'm saying? But I would do it for my actors, you know, or my designers, you know, because our costume designer, who did a magnificent job, and Judy Becker, who's done 4 movies with me, is for the production design, it's magnificent and beautiful. They're nominated. But I wouldn't do it for me. But that's why I made that face for Jennifer. Weirdly, this year, like last weekend, I was at the British Academy Awards. And you get praise from where you never think it's going to come, and it really is a wonderful thing. You can never expect it. I don't read reviews. I listened to Bob Dylan, who just, you know, he just said, you can't read reviews. You know, I count on people around me, loved ones, to tell me how the wind is blowing and if there's something particularly interesting that I should hear that somebody said. I remember vividly every negative thing, and there's no harder critic on me than me. So I skew that way with the work. I don't think I'm indestructible or, you know, flawless. I think that I'm very critical of it forever. So we're back at the BAFTAs, and this time Jennifer Lawrence is not there because she's making a Hunger Games movie like she always is. and this time she wins, much to my astonishment. Okay, so she's not there. So I go up and accept for her last weekend and took the statue from Leonardo DiCaprio. And because I never, when you don't expect it, is when you give a good speech, when you don't make any plans. Because if you plan a speech, I never win if I plan a speech. And so I went up and accepted on her behalf just this last weekend, and I was very proud of her.
David O. Russell, I've really enjoyed talking with you. Thank you so much, and good luck at the Oscars.
Thank you, Terry Gross.
David O. Russell directed and co-wrote American Hustle. He spoke with Terry last Thursday. You can hear their full interview on our website, freshair.npr.org. The French director Claude Lanzmann has spent his life confronting the horrors of Nazism, from fleeing the Gestapo in his youth to fighting in the French Resistance to making a series of documentaries about the Holocaust. The most famous of these is his panoramic 1985 epic Shoah. While that film aimed to capture the Holocaust as a whole, his latest film, The Last of the Unjust, focuses on a single controversial Jewish survivor. Our critic at large, John Power, says it's not only a portrait of a brilliant, elusive man, but a reminder of the elusiveness of historical truth.
When you're faced with something as heinous as the Holocaust, it's tempting to turn it into a simple morality play. This isn't to say one can't pass moral judgments. Hitler and his cohort were undeniably evil. But judging can become a form of lazy evasion, a way of closing the book on the tricky realities of failure, guilt, and complicity. Those complexities lie at the heart of The Last of the Unjust, the new documentary by Claude Lanzmann, the prickly Frenchman whose 1985 work Shoah is often called the best film about the Holocaust. But where Shoah is dauntingly austere, its 9.5 hours offer no commentary or archival footage, The Last of the Unjust has a vivid immediacy. It centers on one man, the late Benjamin Mermelstein, a Viennese rabbi reviled for his complicity with the Nazis. Lanzmann interviewed him for hours back in 1975, getting the pudgy, bespectacled, hyperverbal Mermelstein to explain his side of the story. You see, Mermelstein was one of the Jewish elders who helped oversee the Jewish community during the Third Reich. He was a favorite of the clever, corrupt, anti-Semitic Adolf Eichmann. Mermelstein scoffs at Hannah Arendt's claim that this war criminal was banal. And he eventually became the Jewish leader at Theresienstadt. This was a Czech concentration camp the Nazis dressed up as a model Jewish ghetto for international consumption. In reality, tens of thousands of this camp's residents wound up being murdered, including Mermelstein's two predecessors. Although Mermelstein was himself not a free man, he was despised by his fellow Jewish prisoners. They hated not just his work for the Nazis, but what they perceived as his mania for power. He demanded 70-hour work weeks and spruced up the camp to fool foreign visitors. For all this and more, Mermelstein was widely perceived as a collaborator, concerned with his own survival. After the war, he lived in ignominious obscurity, with some eminent survivors even calling for him to be hanged. I suspect a collaborator is just what Lanzmann expected to find when he tracked him down to Rome and began his interview. Yet from the moment they begin talking, Mermelstein is surprising. Faced with Lanzmann's righteousness and billowing Galois smoke, the cunning 70-year-old Mermelstein doesn't flinch. He justifies himself with such irony, cocky verve, and memory for detail that we begin to see things from his point of view. His words plunge us into what Primo Levi termed the gray zone, that ambiguous moral terrain in which a privileged prisoner like Mermelstein is at once a master and a slave. After all, even if Mermelstein did enjoy power, nobody thinks he freely chose to wield it in a concentration camp. He was trapped within the dirty, dehumanizing system the Nazis imposed on millions of victims. Mermelstein argues that he merely played the terrible hand he was dealt. If he forced his fellow Jews to pretend Theresienstadt was a happy ghetto, it was only because this saved lives there. If he ordered them to work 70-hour weeks, it was to keep them from being exterminated. If they worked, they might be allowed to survive. What he did wasn't heroic or defiant, the way we'd all like to think we'd be, but it might have been rational, given the circumstances. At different times, Mermelstein compares himself to a tightrope walker, to that great realist Sancho Panza, and even to Scheherazade, who tells stories to buy time and keep people alive. The most unsettling thing about him is his detached, even bemused tone. He talks about horrors with no obvious emotion, comparing himself to a surgeon who can't afford to be prey to his feelings. Even as this feels slightly inhuman, I find that it makes him more persuasive. He's not selling his pain, but his truthfulness. And do we buy it? Like Lanzmann, I believe that Mermelstein believes what he's saying. I also believe that he genuinely thought he was doing the right thing. But was he? Were all those Jewish prisoners who knew him simply wrong to think him a self-aggrandizing villain? Is it possible that, like Alec Guinness's mad colonel in The Bridge on the River Kwai, he got so carried away with keeping order and making the system work that he became a tool of the very thing that enslaved him? The Last of the Unjust doesn't resolve these questions definitively. It can't. At one point, Mermelstein declares that he and his fellow Jewish elders can be condemned, but not judged. A line so paradoxical that could be a Zen koan. And this somehow seems fitting. For like so much of what happened in the gray zone, Mermelstein's story remains frustratingly ambiguous. It's a riddle, not an answer.
John Powers writes about TV and film for Vogue and Vogue.com. He reviewed The Last of the Unjust by Claude Lanzmann. Coming up, we explore sonic wonders of the world with acoustic engineer Trevor Cox. This is Fresh Air Weekend. This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross. Our next guest, Trevor Cox, is an acoustic engineer. He's developed new ways of improving sound in theaters and recording studios. He's also studied what he describes as the sonic wonders of the world, like whispering arches and singing sand dunes. His sonic travels have taken him many places, including the North Sea, where he recorded the sound of bottlenose dolphins underwater, and down into a revolting Victorian-era sewer where he discovered a curving sound effect he'd never heard before. Cox is a professor of acoustic engineering at the University of Salford in Manchester, England, and the author of The Sound Book, The Science of the Sonic Wonders of the World. He spoke with Terry last Wednesday and brought some recordings of sounds few people have ever heard.
Trevor Cox, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thanks.
So let's start with the sound of a gunshot. Now, this is a gunshot that you recorded in what's called an anechoic chamber, a chamber with no echo. I want you to describe what this chamber is.
Well, you walk into this chamber through some really large steel doors, and the first thing that kind of strikes you is you're stood on a trampoline floor of wire, because all around you on the floor, on the walls and the ceiling, there are these strange grey foam wedges, and they're there to completely absorb any reflection. So when you hear the gunshot, all you hear is the shot coming straight from the gun to you, or in this case the microphone, and there's no effect of a room at all.
So I'm going to play what a gun sounds like fired in a room with absolutely no echo. And I must say, it's going to be a pretty unimpressive sound. Here it is. Well, that really was mighty unimpressive. My finger snap is more impressive than that. In our studio, which is relatively, you know, it's meant to be a soundproof studio. Why does it sound, you know what, let's play it one more time.
You see, I think you assume that's unimpressive, but actually I'm really impressed by it, because you think of how you normally hear a gun, especially when Hollywood's had their hands on it, how impressive everything sounds and how it booms in the room. As you said, when you click your finger, you get this booming sound. A lot of that is what the room is doing. And we don't normally hear sounds without the effect of a room. We normally have walls around us reflecting sound. So it's kind of, it takes you back. I was quite, you know, when I first recorded that, I thought, did I get the recording right? Did I fire the gun? Because it's just like a click.
Okay, well, so let's do the opposite. You also fired a gun in a room designed to have a lot of reverb. Describe that room for us.
Well, this is quite an incredible place. It's actually an old oil tank. It was buried in the side of the Scottish hills back at the start of the Second World War to protect all the shipping oil from the German bombing. And so it's a vast space. It's kind of the size of a cathedral, and it's just built out of this vast concrete arch. And, we fired a starting pistol in there, exactly the same one you just heard in the anechoic chamber, to measure the acoustic.
Okay, let's hear that one. Wow, it's still echoing. Gee. It sounds like this really loud gun turning into a plane going by.
Yeah, it's quite incredible when you're in there as well, because you can feel the sound.
Wait, it's still
wash
echoing.
Over you.
I still hear it in the background.
Yeah,
it's
when
still
I was
going.
Recording, it is still going. When I was doing the recording, of course, I was staying completely silent so to get all the recording. And I just was watching the digital meter counting up time, and the recording you've got there, it's over a minute long before it died away. And funny enough, it was still dying away when I turned it off, but it was below the threshold of hearing. It was below what I could hear anymore at low frequency, but it was still going when I stopped.
So let me just ask you, if you're in this like huge metal tank, basically, how do you prevent the gun from ricocheting, the bullet from ricocheting?
Oh, well, that was a starting pistol, so it was firing blank, so it was...
Of course, right.
Yeah, it's quite a standard method of measuring concert halls, actually. We would do it in a normal sort of classical concert hall to measure the acoustics, and it's a really quick and easy way. I mean, this tank, which is, as I said, in the middle of nowhere in Scotland, right at the top of Scotland, is also got no power in it. It's got no lighting, it's got no electricity, so you have to be able to measure it with anything, something really easy. So there's no power for a loudspeaker, for example, so we used a gun to excite the space as a way of measuring. But we also had a limitation as well, because the only way into it is down the oil pipes themselves. There are no doors into this place. So you get placed in a horizontal pipe and shoved through a pipe, which isn't much bigger than you are, to actually get into this oil tank.
You know, I don't really think of acoustic engineers as doing this kind of thing, but you're just obsessed with sound.
Yeah, I mean, actually, my whole adventure kind of started when in a sewer of all places, and I would not recommend going into a sewer, but I was asked to do an interview on the acoustics of a sewer, and I thought, well, never been in one, I'll go and see what it's like, and it was as revolting as you can imagine, but it had this most amazing acoustic effect. It was a cylindrical sewer, an old Victorian brick storm drain, and actually the sound would cling to the inside of the brickwork and spiral around and around in circles, and it was quite amazing.
So what did you learn acoustically from that smelly and disgusting but audio fascinating trip?
Well, I think the first thing I took from that was, yeah, actually some amazing acoustics can be in the most unlikely places. And some of the other places I went to, like the oil tank, are not immediately on your list of places to go to if you're thinking of acoustics, or nice places for that matter. But the other thing is that spiralling effect, what I realised was that's the kind of same effect as you get in whispering galleries. There's a variety of them around the world. In England, the most famous one, St. Paul's Cathedral in London, where you go up into the base of the dome of St. Paul's Cathedral and you whisper into the wall, and the sound skims around the inside of the dome to be heard by your friend who's way, way across on the other side. And it sounds like the sound is emerging from the walls, and you have a conversation, you know, 100 feet apart from each other.
So one of the things that you discuss in your book is the sonic wonders that are happening out of our hearing, like the sounds underwater. And as an example, well, you actually brought an example with you of a recording made underwater. And I'd like you to introduce this for us and tell us what we're going to be hearing.
Yeah, this is recorded up near the Arctic, under the Arctic ice. And it's actually bearded seals calling out to each other. And to make this measurement, you need a hydrophone. I'm very lucky that Cornell University gave me a copy of this, because this is one I haven't got to hear myself yet.
You mentioned a hydrophone. This is like a microphone underwater?
Yeah, it's a microphone which works underwater. I mean, our hearing doesn't work very well underwater. If you go swimming, you know that. But similarly, normal microphones don't work very well underwater, and you need special microphones designed to work in water. I mean, aquatic animals use sound all the time, because light doesn't travel very well in water. It soon sort of disperses, hard to see what's going on. But sound can travel huge distances. And that's one of the things these bearded seals are doing, is they can communicate over huge distances with these low-frequency sort of weird glissandos.
Okay, so let's listen, and then you can tell us more about it. Say, that's the kind of sound you'd expect to hear in a science fiction movie.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds like UFOs landing or something, doesn't it? I mean, there are some animals which make the most strange sounds.
And those were seals?
Yeah, they're bearded seals. And you'd be the males calling out to the females, and I'm quite possibly saying, you know, come over here, I'm the best male to mate with. And the thing is, the male is attracting the female by doing a song. And so what it does is it tries to show its vocal athleticism, to show it's really particularly fit to be mated with. And I guess one of the things they might do is over time extend their glissandos longer and longer and longer, because it's more and more impressive to the female. And it's common in animals, you know, have these most strange calls, but they're sort of kind of, it's a way of attracting the female or defending their territory.
How does sound travel underwater?
Well, much more efficiently than it does in air. I mean, it's the same kind of process in the fact you've got a wave, and in air it's being passed from air molecule to air molecule, whereas underwater it's being passed from water molecule to water molecule. And it just happens to be in water, it goes further, which is another reason why aquatic animals like to use it, because it can travel huge, great distances underwater in a way that it never would do in the air. It would die away much quicker.
Let's talk about one of the sonic wonders of the world, which is a really familiar sound, and that's just like thunder. As an acoustic engineer, tell us your version of what's happening with loud thunder.
Well, what's amazing with thunder is when you hear it, I mean, it's obviously got that crack, and then it's got the rumble afterwards. that when, as a kid, when you drew thunderstorms, you would have drawn the lightning with that jagged line. If you didn't have the jagged line, you wouldn't have the rumble of the thunder. So it's quite interesting how, you know, just something of visual look of lightning is really crucial to how the thunder sounds. So when you draw a jagged line like that, each little kink is actually generating the sound. And the reason the thunder rumbles is because the sound takes different time to come from different kinks, because they're all slightly different distances from you. And that's the reason you get that very distinctive rumble sound.
Oh, I always figured the rumbling was because it was like echoing all around, you know, the buildings or the woods or wherever you are.
Well, you, I mean, in woods you will get echoing. But no, this is the rumble is due to the fact that the sound is made all the way along the lightning strike, all the way along the sort of the bright light, because it's basically created when the air is suddenly heated up and you get all these shock waves generating. But because that strike, you know, there's long, you know, bright light is all different distances from you. Some of it arrives quickly from because it's nearer you, and some of it arrives slower because it's further away. So you get this sort of extended sound. So if you've ever been near when the lightning is strike, you don't hear the rumble. You just hear the loud crack, really. And that rumble really only really is more obvious the further away you are.
Why is wind noisy?
Well, wind on its own isn't particularly, it's just got to hit something to make it noisy. And Manchester, at the moment, the best example of that is the Beetham Tower in the city centre. So we have this tower block in the city centre which howls in the wind. And we've just, as well as having a really damp January and mild January, we've had a really, really windy winter. And only a couple of days ago, it was so loud, it was waking people up in the town centre. And the wind itself was hitting, there's a structure on top of this Beetham Tower, which is a whole set of glass sort of panes. And it was hitting those, and it was creating a whistling sound, which was being amplified. So it's like some giant wind harp up there, and it creates all sorts of noise problems.
Hmm. So when you say that wind isn't inherently noisy, what creates the noise?
What creates noise in the first place is turbulence. So if I was to pick up a beer bottle and blow across it, what you have is you have air sort of hitting the edge and creating sort of eddies. I mean, you see turbulence in the water. So if I have a smooth running river and I put a rock in, you suddenly see that white water. That's turbulence of the water. The same thing's happening around the bottleneck. When I blow across it, you just can't see it, obviously, because it's sound and you can't see the air molecules moving. And then that sort of turbulence creates a sort of kind of a vague noise, but it will lock into the resonance of the air in the main bit of the bottle. And that's what actually creates a distinctive tone. And it's how flutes work. It's how if you ever hear wind whistling past railings, that's what you get. If you hear an aerolian harp, it's created by turbulence, slightly different way. But it's mostly created by turbulence of some form.
What's one of the sonic wonders of the world that you find most fascinating that I have not yet asked you about?
It's really hard to pick a favourite or most amazing one because there's just so many. But I must say I really enjoyed going to the Mojave Desert to hear the booming sand dunes. And I think when I first thought of this idea of going to find the sort of amazing sounds in the world, high up on my list was singing sands, because they'd been written about for centuries. You know, Marco Polo, there's ancient Chinese writing on them, Charles Darwin wrote about them. So they've been known about for some time, but also there's a lot of scientific controversy. There's been groups arguing about what causes them, which is also interesting, tweaked my sort of scientific mind. But to go and see one is not very, you know, go and hear this is not very easy because you need to find a desert. And there's no, I mean, the nearest one to England would probably be Morocco, but I haven't been to America, so I went to the southwest where there's quite a few around in the southwest, and the Kelso Dunes and the Mojave Desert do it. So you climb up onto this dune, which is really hard work because it's got to be really dry, so it's got to be the heat of the summer, and the sand is really loose because if it's not loose, it doesn't work. And it's amazing when you walk across it because you get this burping sound, you know, a bit like a badly played tuba going, even just walking across it. But the sound that people write about is the sound what you create with an avalanche. So you find the right slope and you scoot down on your backside and you'll get this rumbling sound, which is a drone that picks up a bit like a taxiing aircraft. And actually you can feel the whole surface vibrate underneath you, and it's quite an amazing effect.
So did you do that?
Yeah, we were unlucky on day one. We arrived there and we couldn't get it to work. And someone had said Kelso Dunes wasn't as tuneful as it used to be. So we went back and sort of evaluated, you know, overnight, looked back at, you know, some of the papers people have written about it and sort of kind of trying to work out. And I think the mistake we made on day one is we looked at this big dune and thought, right, let's go to the top. We'll start there. Well, actually, the best slope was about three quarters of the way up. So on the second day, we found one which was better angled to the wind. And the thing is, what happens when these sand grains have to be all roughly the same size, they have to be roughly spherical, they have to have a special varnish on them. So there's a sort of weird sifting happening of the sand grains in the wind in the Mojave Desert. And so you have to find one which is right, you know, a bit of the dune which is at the right angle to the prevailing wind direction as well. And I think the first day we weren't quite at the right angle. Day two we got it better and we found a bigger slope and we got some beautiful drones.
So you actually have a recording of this singing sand dune. Do you want to introduce it for us?
Yeah, there's two recordings actually worth playing. The first one is this burping effect, as it's described, and it's just me walking up the dune. You might even hear me panting a bit because it's quite hard work.
Okay, let's go with that.
The second sound, which is the sort of the more famous droning sound, is then me coming down on my backside and creating an avalanche. And it's quite low frequency, so you need to turn the bass up to hear it.
And it's not really an avalanche, it's just the sound of an avalanche?
It's actually a synchronized avalanche of all the grains. So all the grains move in one and therefore create a sort of a sound, which is very tonal. Normally with an avalanche, just like a snow avalanche, everything's just a kind of general sort of noise. But because the grains are all the same size, they slip past each other in synchronization, and you get this amazing droning sound.
Okay, let's hear it. Do you find it really weird when something makes a sound that it doesn't seem to be capable of making? Like, why would sand make a sound like that?
Yeah, to me, when I was looking for these sort of sonic wonders, one of my things was, you know, well, what to go and see? I could go and see lots of things. And I think the sounds which are remarkable are some of the ones which are kind of are surprising. And for me, I've been to lots of sand dunes in my time, but none of them make a sound. It's, you know, had to work quite hard to find this place, and that's what makes it remarkable. There's about 40 documented around the world which make that particular sound. There's probably a few more to be found, but people don't tend to go into the middle of deserts to find them. So there's probably a few more, but they're relatively rare. And also, it had a nice kind of science story behind it, which was another reason why I wanted to visit.
Well, Trevor Cox, thank you so much for talking with us.
That's been great. Thanks very much.
Trevor Cox is the author of The Sound Book, The Science of the Sonic Wonders of the World. He spoke with Terry last Wednesday. Fresh Air Weekend was produced by an FBI agent played by Bradley Cooper. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer and technical director is Audrey Bentham. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Roberta Shorrock, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, John Myers, Heidi Simon, and Teresa Madden. Our administrative assistant is Dorothy Farabee. Molly C.V. Nesper is our associate producer of online media. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies.